into a small class of superhumans and a massive underclass of useless Homo sapiens. To make an already ominous situation even worse, as the masses lose their economic importance and political power, the state might lose at least some of the incentive to invest in their health, education, and welfare. It's very dangerous to be redundant. The future of the masses will then depend on the goodwill of a small elite. Maybe there is goodwill for a few decades, but in a time of crisis, like climate catastrophe, it would be very tempting and easy to toss the superfluous people overboard. In countries such as France and New Zealand, with a long tradition of liberal beliefs and welfare state practices, perhaps the elite will go on taking care of the masses, even when it doesn't need them. In the more capitalist United States, however, the elite might use the first opportunity to dismantle what's left of the American welfare state. An even bigger problem looms in large developing countries such as India, China, South Africa, and Brazil. There, once common people lose their economic value, inequality might skyrocket. Consequently, instead of globalization resulting in global unity, it might actually result in speciation, the divergence of humankind into different biological castes or even different species. Globalization will unite the world horizontally by erasing national borders, but it will simultaneously divide humanity vertically. Ruling oligarchies in countries as diverse as the United States and Russia might merge and make common cause against the mass of ordinary humans. From this perspective, current populist resentment of the elites is well-founded. If we are not careful, the grandchildren of Silicon Valley tycoons and Moscow billionaires might become a separate species, superior to the grandchildren of Appalachian hillbillies and Siberian villagers. In the long run, such a scenario might even de-globalize the world, as the upper caste congregates inside a self-proclaimed civilization and builds walls and moats to separate it from the hordes of barbarians outside. In the 20th century, industrial civilization depended on the barbarians for cheap labor, raw materials, and markets, and it often conquered and absorbed them. But in the 21st century, a post-industrial civilization relying on AI, bioengineering, and nanotechnology might be far more self-contained and self-sustaining. Not just entire classes, but entire countries and continents might become irrelevant. Fortifications guarded by drones and robots might separate the self-proclaimed civilized zone, where cyborgs fight one another with logic bombs, from the barbarian lands where feral humans fight one another with machetes and Kalashnikovs. Throughout this book, I often use the first-person plural to speak about the future of humankind. I talk about what we need to do about our problems. But maybe there is no we. Maybe one of our biggest problems is that different human groups have completely different futures. Maybe in some parts of the world you should teach your kids to write computer code, while in others you had better teach them to draw fast and shoot straight. Who owns the data? If we want to prevent the concentration of all wealth and power in the hands of a small elite, the key is to regulate the ownership of data. In ancient times, land was the most important asset in the world. Politics was a struggle to control land, and if too much land became concentrated in too few hands, society split into aristocrats and commoners. In the modern era, machines and factories became more important than land, and political struggles focused on controlling these vital means of production. If too many of the machines became concentrated in too few hands, society split into capitalists and proletarians. In the 21st century, however, data will eclipse both land and machinery as the most important asset, and politics will be a struggle to control the flow of data. If data becomes concentrated in too few hands, humankind will split into different species. The race to obtain the data is already on, headed by data giants such as Google, Facebook, Baidu, and Tencent. So far, many of these giants seem to have adopted the business model of attention merchants. They capture our attention by providing us with free information, services, and entertainment, and they then resell our attention to advertisers. Yet the data giants probably aim far higher than any previous attention merchant. Their true business isn't to sell advertisements at all. Rather, by capturing our attention, they manage to accumulate immense amounts of data about us, which is worth more than any advertising revenue. We aren't their customers. We are their product. In the medium term, this data hoard opens a path to a radically different business model, whose first victim will be the advertising industry itself. The new model is based on transferring authority from humans to algorithms, including the authority to choose and buy things. Once algorithms choose and buy things for us, the traditional advertising industry will go bust. Consider Google. Google wants to reach a point where we can ask it anything and get the best answer in the world. What will happen once we can say to Google, "Hi, Google. Based on everything you know about cars, and based on everything you know about me, including my needs, my habits, my views on global warming, and even my opinions about Middle Eastern politics, what is the best car for me?" If Google can give us a good answer to that, and if we learn by experience to trust Google's wisdom instead of our own easily manipulated feelings, what could possibly be the use of car advertisements? In the longer term, by bringing together enough data and enough computing power, the data giants could hack the deepest secrets of life, and then use this knowledge not just to make choices for us or manipulate us, but also to re-engineer organic life and create inorganic life forms. Selling advertisements may be necessary to sustain the giants in the short term, but tech companies often evaluate apps, products, and other companies according to the data they harvest, rather than according to the money they generate. A popular app may lack a business model and may even lose money in the short term, but as long as it sucks data, it could be worth billions. Even if you don't know how to cash in on the data today, it is worth having it because it might hold the key to controlling and shaping life in the future. I don't know for certain that the data giants explicitly think about this in such terms, but their actions indicate that they value the accumulation of data in terms beyond those of mere dollars and cents. Ordinary humans will find it very difficult to resist this process. At present, people are happy to give away their most valuable asset, their personal data, in exchange for free email services and funny cat videos. It's a bit like African and Native American tribes who unwittingly sold entire countries to European imperialists in exchange for colourful beads and cheap trinkets. If, later on, ordinary people decide to try to block the flow of data, they might find it increasingly difficult, especially as they might come to rely on the network for all their decisions, and even for their healthcare and physical survival. Humans and machines might merge so completely that humans will not be able to survive at all if they are disconnected from the network. They will be connected, starting in the womb, and if, later in life, you choose to disconnect, insurance agencies might refuse to insure you, employers might refuse to employ you, and healthcare services might refuse to take care of you. In the big battle between health and privacy, health is likely to win, hands down. As more and more data flows from your body and brain to smart machines via biometric sensors, it will become easy for corporations and government agencies to know you, manipulate you, and make decisions on your behalf. Even more important, they could be able to decipher the deep mechanisms of all bodies and brains, and thereby gain the power to engineer life. If we want to prevent a small elite from monopolizing such godlike powers, and if we want to prevent humankind from splitting into biological castes, the key question is, who owns the data? Does the data about my DNA, my brain, and my life belong to me, to the government, to a corporation, or to the human collective? Mandating governments to nationalize the data will probably curb the power of big corporations, but it might also result in creepy digital dictatorships. Politicians are a bit like musicians, and the instrument they play on is the human emotional and biochemical system. They give a speech, and there is a wave of fear in the country. They tweet, and there is an explosion of hatred. I don't think we should give these musicians a more sophisticated instrument to play on. Once politicians can press our emotional buttons directly, generating anxiety, hatred, joy, and boredom at will, politics will become a mere emotional circus. As much as we should fear the power of big corporations, history suggests that we are not necessarily better off in the hands of overly mighty governments. As of March 2018, I would prefer to give my data to Mark Zuckerberg than to Vladimir Putin, though the Cambridge Analytica scandal revealed that perhaps there isn't much of a choice here, as any data entrusted to Zuckerberg may well find its way to Putin. Private ownership of one's own data may sound more attractive than either of these options, but it is unclear what it actually means. We have had thousands of years of experience in regulating the ownership of land. We know how to build a fence around a field, place a guard at the gate, and control who can go in. Over the past two centuries, we have become extremely sophisticated in regulating the ownership of industry. Thus, today I can own a piece of General Motors and a bit of Toyota by buying their shares. But we don't have much experience in regulating the ownership of data, which is inherently a far more difficult task, because unlike land and machines, data is everywhere and nowhere at the same time. It can move at the speed of light, and you can create as many copies of it as you want. So we had better call upon our lawyers, politicians, philosophers, and even poets to turn their attention to this conundrum. How do you regulate the ownership of data? This may well be the most important political question of our era. If we cannot answer this question soon, our socio-political system might collapse. People are already sensing the coming cataclysm. Perhaps this is why citizens all over the world are losing faith in the liberal story, which just a decade ago seemed irresistible. How, then, do we go forward from here? And how do we cope with the immense challenges of the biotech and infotech revolutions? Perhaps the very same scientists and entrepreneurs who disrupted the world in the first place can engineer some technological solution. For example, might networked algorithms form the scaffolding for a global human community that could collectively own all the data and oversee the future development of life? As global inequality rises and social tensions increase around the world, perhaps Mark Zuckerberg could call upon his 2 billion friends to join forces and do something together. Part 2. The Political Challenge. The merger of infotech and biotech threatens the core modern values of liberty and equality. Any solution to the technological challenge has to involve global cooperation. But nationalism, religion, and culture divide humankind into hostile camps and make it very difficult to cooperate on a global level. 5. Community. Humans have bodies. California is used to earthquakes, but the political tremor of the 2016 U.S. elections still came as a rude shock to Silicon Valley. Realizing that they might be part of the problem, the computer wizards reacted by doing what engineers do best. They searched for a technical solution. Nowhere was the reaction more forceful than in Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park. This is understandable. Since Facebook's business is social networking, it is most attuned to social disturbances. After 3 months of soul-searching, on February 16, 2017, Mark Zuckerberg published an audacious manifesto on the need to build a global community, and on Facebook's role in that project. In a follow-up speech at the inaugural Communities Summit on June 22, 2017, Zuckerberg explained that the socio-political upheavals of our time, from rampant drug addiction to murderous totalitarian regimes, result to a large extent from the disintegration of human communities. He lamented the fact that, for decades, membership in all kinds of groups has declined as much as one quarter. That's a lot of people who now need to find a sense of purpose and support somewhere else. He promised that Facebook would lead the charge to rebuild these communities, and that his engineers would pick up the burden discarded by parish priests. "We're going to start rolling out some tools," he said, "to make it easier to build communities." He further explained, We started a project to see if we could get better at suggesting groups that will be meaningful to you. We started building artificial intelligence to do this, and it works. In the first 6 months, we helped 50% more people join meaningful communities. His ultimate goal is to help 1 billion people join meaningful communities. If we can do this, it will not only turn around the whole decline in community membership we've seen for decades, it will start to strengthen our social fabric and bring the world closer together. This is such an important goal that Zuckerberg vowed to change Facebook's whole mission to take this on. Zuckerberg is certainly correct in lamenting the breakdown of human communities. Yet several months after Zuckerberg made this vow, and just as this book was going to print, the Cambridge Analytica scandal revealed that data entrusted to Facebook was harvested by third parties and used to manipulate elections around the world. This made a mockery of Zuckerberg's lofty promises and shattered public trust in Facebook. One can only hope that before undertaking the building of new human communities, Facebook first commits itself to protecting the privacy and security of existing communities. It is nevertheless worthwhile to consider Facebook's communal vision in depth and examine whether, once security is beefed up, online social networks can help build a global human community. Though in the 21st century humans might be upgraded into gods, as of 2018 we are still Stone Age animals. In order to flourish, we still need to ground ourselves in intimate communities. For millions of years, humans have been adapted to living in small bands of no more than a few dozen people. Even today, most of us find it impossible to really know more than 150 individuals, irrespective of how many Facebook friends we boast. And if we don't belong to any intimate community, we humans feel lonely and alienated. Unfortunately, over the past two centuries, intimate communities have been disintegrating. The attempt to replace small groups of people who actually know one another with the imagined communities of nations and political parties will never succeed in full. Your millions of brothers in the national family and your millions of comrades in the Communist Party cannot provide you with the warm intimacy that a single real sibling or friend can. Consequently, people live ever more lonely lives in an ever more connected planet. Many of the social and political disruptions of our time can be traced back to this malaise. Zuckerberg's vision of reconnecting humans to one another is, therefore, a timely and noble one. But words are cheaper than actions, and in order to implement this vision, Facebook might have to change its entire business model. You can hardly build a global community when you make your money from capturing people's attention and selling it to advertisers. Despite this, Zuckerberg's willingness to even formulate such a vision deserves praise. Most corporations believe that they should focus on making money, governments should do as little as possible, and humankind should trust market forces to make the really important decisions on our behalf. So if Facebook intends to make a real ideological commitment to building human communities, those who fear its power should not push it back into the corporate cocoon with cries of Big Brother. Instead, we should urge other corporations, institutions, and governments to challenge Facebook by making their own ideological commitments. Of course, there is no lack of organizations that lament the breakdown of human communities and strive to rebuild them. A wide variety of groups, from feminist activists to Islamic fundamentalists, are in the business of community building, and we will examine some of these efforts in later chapters. What makes Facebook's gambit unique is its global scope, its corporate backing, and its deep faith in technology. Zuckerberg sounds convinced that the new Facebook AI can not only identify meaningful communities, but also strengthen our social fabric and bring the world closer together. That is far more ambitious than using AI to drive a car or diagnose cancer. Facebook's community vision is perhaps the first explicit attempt to use AI for centrally planned social engineering on a global scale. It therefore constitutes a crucial test case. If it succeeds, we are likely to see many more such attempts, and algorithms will be acknowledged as the new masters of human social networks. If it fails, it will uncover the limitations of the new technologies. Algorithms may be good for navigating vehicles and curing diseases, but when it comes to solving social problems, we should still rely on politicians and priests. Online versus offline. In recent years, Facebook has had astonishing success, and it currently has more than 2 billion active users. Yet, in order to implement its new vision, it will have to bridge the chasm between online and offline. A community may begin as an online gathering, but in order to truly flourish, it will have to put down roots in the offline world too. If one day some dictator bars Facebook from his country, or completely pulls the plug on the internet, will the communities evaporate, or will they regroup and fight back? Will they be able to organize a demonstration without online communication? Zuckerberg explained in his February 2017 manifesto that online communities help foster offline ones. This is sometimes true. Yet in many cases, online comes at the expense of offline, and there is a fundamental difference between the two. Physical communities have a depth that virtual communities cannot match, at least not in the near future. If I lie in bed sick at home in Israel, my online friends from California can talk to me, but they cannot bring me soup or a cup of tea. Humans have bodies. During the last century, technology has been distancing us from our bodies. We have been losing our ability to pay attention to what we smell and taste. Instead, we are absorbed in our smartphones and computers. We are more interested in what is happening in cyberspace than in what is happening down the street. It is easier than ever to talk to my cousin in Switzerland, but it is harder to talk to my husband over breakfast because he constantly looks at his smartphone instead of at me. In the past, humans could not afford such carelessness. Ancient foragers were always alert and attentive. Wandering in the forest in search of mushrooms, they watched the ground for any telltale bulge. They listened to the slightest movement in the grass to learn whether a snake might be lurking there. When they found an edible mushroom, they examined it with the utmost attention to distinguish it from its poisonous cousins. Members of today's affluent societies don't need such keen awareness. We can wander the supermarket aisles while texting messages, and we can buy any of 1,000 dishes, all supervised by the health authorities. But whatever we choose, we might end up eating it in haste in front of a screen, checking emails or watching television, while hardly paying attention to the actual taste. Zuckerberg says that Facebook is committed to continue improving our tools to give you the power to share your experience with others. Yet what people might really need are the tools to connect to their own experiences. In the name of sharing experiences, people are encouraged to understand what happens to them in terms of how others see it. If something exciting happens, the gut instinct of Facebook users is to pull out their smartphones, take a picture, post it online, and wait for the likes. In the process, they barely notice what they themselves feel. Indeed, what they feel is increasingly determined by the online reactions. People estranged from their bodies, senses, and physical environment are likely to feel alienated and disoriented. Pundits often blame such feelings of alienation on the decline of religious and national bonds, but losing touch with your body is probably more important. Humans lived for millions of years without religions and without nations. They can probably live happily without them in the 21st century, too. Yet they cannot live happily if they are disconnected from their bodies. If you don't feel at home in your body, you will never feel at home in the world. Up till now, Facebook's own business model encouraged people to spend more and more time online, even if that meant having less time and energy to devote to offline activities. Can it adopt a new model that encourages people to go online only when it is really necessary, and to devote more attention to their physical environment and to their own bodies and senses? What would Facebook's shareholders think about this model? A blueprint of such an alternative model has been suggested recently by Tristan Harris, a tech philosopher and former Google employee, who came up with a new metric of time well spent. The limitations of online relationships also undermine Zuckerberg's solution to social polarization. He rightly points out that just connecting people and exposing them to different opinions will not bridge social divides, because showing people an article from the opposite perspective actually deepens polarization by framing other perspectives as foreign. Instead, Zuckerberg suggests that the best solutions for improving discourse may come from getting to know each other as whole people instead of just opinions, something Facebook may be uniquely suited to do. If we connect with people about what we have in common, sports teams, TV shows, interests, it is easier to have dialogue about what we disagree on. Yet it is extremely difficult to know each other as whole people. It takes a lot of time, and it demands direct physical interaction. As noted earlier, the average Homo sapiens is probably incapable of intimately knowing more than 150 individuals. Ideally, building communities should not be a zero-sum game. Humans can feel loyal to different groups at the same time. Unfortunately, intimate relations probably are a zero-sum game. Beyond a certain point, the time and energy you spend on getting to know your online friends from Iran or Nigeria will come at the expense of your ability to know your next-door neighbors. Facebook's crucial test will come when an engineer invents a new tool that causes people to spend less time buying stuff online and more time in meaningful offline activities with friends. Will Facebook adopt or suppress such a tool? Will Facebook take a true leap of faith and privilege social concerns over financial interests? If it does so, and manages to avoid bankruptcy, that will be a momentous transformation. Devoting more attention to the offline world than to its quarterly reports also has a bearing on Facebook's taxation policies. Like Amazon, Google, Apple, and several other tech giants, Facebook has been repeatedly accused of tax evasion. The difficulties inherent in taxing online activities make it easier for these global corporations to engage in all sorts of creative accounting. If you think that people live mainly online and that you provide them with all the necessary tools for their online existence, you can view yourself as a beneficial social service, even as you avoid paying taxes to offline governments. But once you remember that human beings have bodies, and that they therefore still need roads, hospitals, and sewage systems, it becomes far more difficult to justify tax evasion. How can you extol the virtues of community while refusing to financially support the most important community services? We can only hope that Facebook can change its business model, adopt a more offline-friendly tax policy, help unite the world, and still remain profitable. Yet we should not cultivate unrealistic expectations about Facebook's ability to realize its global community vision. Historically, corporations were not the ideal vehicle for leading social and political revolutions. A real revolution, sooner or later, demands sacrifices that corporations, their employees, and their shareholders are not willing to make. That's why revolutionaries establish churches, political parties, and armies. The so-called Facebook and Twitter revolutions in the Arab world started in hopeful online communities, but once they emerged into the messy offline world, they were commandeered by religious fanatics and military juntas. If Facebook now aims to instigate a global revolution, it will have to do a much better job in bridging the gap between online and offline. It and the other online giants tend to view humans as audio-visual animals, a pair of eyes and a pair of ears connected to 10 fingers, a screen, and a credit card. A crucial step toward uniting humankind is to appreciate that humans have bodies. Of course, this appreciation, too, has its downside. Realizing the limitations of online algorithms might only prompt the tech giants to extend their reach further. Devices such as Google Glass and games such as Pokemon Go are designed to erase the distinction between online and offline, merging them into a single augmented reality. On an even deeper level, biometric sensors and direct brain-to-computer interfaces aim to erode the border between electronic machines and organic bodies, and to literally get under our skin. Once the tech giants come to terms with the human body, they might end up manipulating our entire bodies in the same way they currently manipulate our eyes, fingers, and credit cards. We may come to miss the good old days when online was separated from offline. 6. Civilization. There is just one civilization in the world. While Mark Zuckerberg dreams of uniting humankind online, recent events in the offline world seem to breathe fresh life into the Clash of Civilizations thesis. Many pundits, politicians, and ordinary citizens believe that the Syrian civil war, the rise of the Islamic State, the Brexit mayhem, and the instability of the European Union all result from a clash between Western civilization and Islamic civilization. They believe that Western attempts to impose democracy and human rights on Muslim nations resulted in a violent Islamic backlash, and a wave of Muslim immigration, coupled with Islamic terrorist attacks, caused European voters to abandon multicultural dreams in favor of xenophobic local identities. According to this thesis, humankind has always been divided into diverse civilizations whose members view the world in irreconcilable ways. These incompatible worldviews make conflicts between civilizations inevitable. Just as in nature, different species fight for survival according to the remorseless laws of natural selection, so, throughout history, civilizations have repeatedly clashed, and only the fittest have survived to tell the tale. Those who overlook this grim fact, be they liberal politicians or head-in-the-clouds engineers, do so at their peril. The Clash of Civilizations thesis has far-reaching political implications. Its supporters contend that any attempt to reconcile the West with the Muslim world is doomed to failure. Muslim countries will never adopt Western values, and Western countries will never successfully absorb Muslim minorities. Accordingly, the United States should not admit immigrants from Syria or Iraq, and the European Union should renounce its multicultural fallacy in favor of an unabashed Western identity. In the long run, only one civilization can survive the unforgiving tests of natural selection, and if the bureaucrats in Brussels refuse to save the West from the Islamic peril, then Britain, Denmark, or France had better go it alone. Though widely held, this thesis is misleading. Islamic fundamentalism may indeed pose a radical challenge, but the civilization it challenges is a global civilization rather than a uniquely Western phenomenon. And even Islamic fundamentalists, for all their medieval fantasies, are grounded in contemporary global culture far more than in 7th century Arabia. They are catering to the fears and hopes of alienated modern youth, rather than to those of medieval peasants and merchants. As Pankaj Mishra and Christopher de Bellaigue have convincingly argued, radical Islamists have been influenced by Marx and Foucault as much as by Muhammad, and they have inherited the legacy of 19th century European anarchists as much as the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs. It is therefore more accurate to see even the Islamic State as an errant offshoot of the global culture we all share, rather than as a branch of some mysterious and alien tree. More important, the analogy between history and biology that underpins the Clash of Civilizations thesis is false. Human groups, all the way from small tribes to huge civilizations, are fundamentally different from animal species, and historical conflicts differ greatly from natural selection processes. Animal species have objective identities that endure for thousands upon thousands of generations. Whether you are a chimpanzee or a gorilla depends on your genes rather than your beliefs, and different genes dictate distinct social behaviors. Chimpanzees live in mixed groups of males and females. They compete for power by building coalitions of supporters from among both sexes. Amid gorillas, in contrast, a single dominant male establishes a harem of females and usually expels any adult male that might challenge his position. Chimpanzees cannot adopt gorilla-like social arrangements. Gorillas cannot start organizing themselves like chimpanzees, And as far as we know, exactly the same social systems have characterized chimpanzees and gorillas, not only in recent decades, but for hundreds of thousands of years. You find nothing like that among humans. Yes, human groups may have distinct social systems, but these are not genetically determined, and they seldom endure for more than a few centuries. Think of 20th century Germans, for example. In less than 100 years, the Germans organized themselves into 6 very different systems. The Hohenzollern Empire, the Weimar Republic, the Third Reich, the German Democratic Republic, a.k.a. Communist East Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany, a.k.a. West Germany, and finally Democratic Reunited Germany. Of course, the Germans kept their language and their love of beer and bratwurst. But is there some unique German essence that distinguishes them from all other nations and that has remained unchanged from Wilhelm II to Angela Merkel? And if you do come up with something, was it also there 1,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago? The unratified preamble of the European Constitution begins by stating that it draws inspiration from the cultural, religious, and humanist inheritance of Europe, from which have developed the universal values of the inviolable and inalienable rights of the human person, democracy, equality, freedom, and the rule of law. This may easily give one the impression that European civilization is defined by the values of human rights, democracy, equality, and freedom. Countless speeches and documents draw a direct line from ancient Athenian democracy to the present-day European Union, celebrating 2,500 years of European freedom and democracy. This is reminiscent of the proverbial blind man who takes hold of an elephant's tail and concludes that an elephant is a kind of brush. Yes, democratic ideas have been part of European culture for centuries, but they were never the whole. For all its glory and impact, Athenian democracy was a half-hearted experiment that survived for barely 200 years in a small corner of the Balkans. If European civilization for the past 25 centuries has been defined by democracy and human rights, what are we to make of Sparta and Julius Caesar, of the Crusaders and the Conquistadores, of the Inquisition and the slave trade, of Louis XIV and Napoleon, of Hitler and Stalin? Were they all intruders from some foreign civilization? In truth, European civilization is anything Europeans make of it, just as Christianity is anything Christians make of it, Islam is anything Muslims make of it, and Judaism is anything Jews make out of it. And they have made of it remarkably different things over the centuries. Human groups are defined more by the changes they undergo than by any continuity, but they nevertheless manage to create for themselves ancient identities thanks to their storytelling skills. No matter what revolutions they experience, they can usually weave old and new into a single yarn. Even an individual can knit revolutionary personal changes into a coherent and powerful life story. I am that person who was once a socialist, but then became a capitalist. I was born in France, and now I live in the United States. I was married and then got divorced. I had cancer and then got well again. Similarly, a human group, such as the Germans, may come to define itself by the very changes it underwent. Once we were Nazis, but we have learned our lesson, and now we are peaceful Democrats. You don't need to look for some unique German essence that manifested itself first in Wilhelm II, then in Hitler, and finally in Merkel. These radical transformations are precisely what define German identity. To be German in 2018 means to grapple with the difficult legacy of Nazism while upholding liberal and democratic values. Who knows what it will mean in 2050? People often refuse to recognize these changes, especially when it comes to core political and religious values. We insist that our values are a precious legacy from ancient ancestors. Yet the only thing that allows us to say this is that our ancestors are long dead and cannot speak for themselves. Consider, for example, Jewish attitudes toward women. Nowadays, ultra-Orthodox Jews ban images of women from the public sphere. billboards and advertisements aimed at ultra-Orthodox Jews usually depict only men and boys, never women and girls. In 2011, a scandal erupted when the ultra-Orthodox Brooklyn paper Die Zeitung published a photo of American officials watching the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound, but digitally erased all women from the photo, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The paper explained it was forced to do so by Jewish laws of modesty. A similar scandal erupted when the paper Chamevasa expunged Angela Merkel from a photo of a demonstration against the Charlie Hebdo massacre, lest her image arouse any lustful thoughts in the minds of devout readers. The publisher of a third ultra-Orthodox newspaper, Chamudia, defended this policy by explaining, "We are backed by thousands of years of Jewish tradition." Nowhere is the ban on seeing women stricter than in the synagogue. In Orthodox synagogues, women are carefully segregated from the men and must confine themselves to a restricted zone where they are hidden behind a curtain, so that no man will accidentally see the shape of a woman as he says his prayers or reads scriptures. Yet, if all this is backed by thousands of years of Jewish tradition and immutable divine laws, how to explain the fact that when archaeologists excavated ancient synagogues in Israel from the time of the Mishnah and Talmud, they found no sign of gender segregation, and instead uncovered beautiful floor mosaics and wall paintings depicting women, some of them rather scantily dressed? The rabbis who wrote the Mishnah and Talmud regularly prayed and studied in these synagogues, but present-day Orthodox Jews would consider them blasphemous desecrations of ancient traditions. Similar distortions of ancient traditions characterize all religions. The Islamic State has boasted that it has reverted to the pure and original version of Islam, but in truth, their take on Islam is brand new. Yes, they quote many venerable texts, but they exercise a lot of discretion in choosing which texts to quote, which to ignore, and how to interpret them. Indeed, their do-it-yourself attitude to interpreting the holy texts is itself very modern. Traditionally, interpretation was the monopoly of the learned ulama, scholars who studied Muslim law and theology in reputable institutions such as Cairo's Al-Azhar. Few of the Islamic State's leaders have had such credentials, and most respected ulama have dismissed Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and his ilk as ignorant criminals. That does not mean that the Islamic State has been un-Islamic or anti-Islamic, as some people argue. It is particularly ironic when Christian leaders such as Barack Obama have the temerity to tell self-professing Muslims such as Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi what it means to be Muslim. The heated argument about the true essence of Islam is simply pointless. Islam has no fixed DNA. Islam is whatever Muslims make of it. Germans and gorillas. There is an even deeper difference distinguishing human groups from animal species. Species often split, but they never merge. About 7 million years ago, chimpanzees and gorillas had common ancestors. This single ancestral species split into two populations that eventually went their separate evolutionary ways. Once this happened, there was no going back. Since individuals belonging to different species cannot produce fertile offspring together, species can never merge. Gorillas cannot merge with chimpanzees, giraffes cannot merge with elephants, and dogs cannot merge with cats. Human tribes, in contrast, tend to coalesce over time into larger and larger groups. Modern Germans were created from the merger of Saxons, Prussians, Swabians, and Bavarians, who not so long ago wasted little love on one another. Otto von Bismarck allegedly remarked, having read Darwin's On the Origin of Species, that the Bavarian is the missing link between the Austrian and the human. The French were created from the merger of Franks, Normans, Bretons, Gascons, and Provençals. Meanwhile, across the Channel, English, Scots, Welsh, and Irish were gradually welded together, willingly or not, to form Britons. In the not-too-distant future, Germans, French, and Britons might yet merge into Europeans. Mergers don't always last, as people in London, Edinburgh, and Brussels are keenly aware these days. Brexit may well initiate the simultaneous unravelling of both the United Kingdom and the European Union, but over the long run, history's direction is clear-cut. 10,000 years ago, humankind was divided into countless isolated tribes. With each passing millennium, these fused into larger and larger groups, creating fewer and fewer distinct civilizations. In recent generations, the few remaining civilizations have been blending into a single global civilization. Political, ethnic, cultural, and economic divisions endure, but they do not undermine the fundamental unity. Indeed, some divisions are made possible only by an overarching common structure. In the economy, for example, the division of labor cannot succeed unless everyone shares a single market. One country cannot specialize in producing cars or oil unless it can buy food from other countries that grow wheat and rice. The process of human unification has taken two distinct forms, establishing links between distinct groups and homogenizing practices across groups. Links may be formed even between groups that continue to behave very differently. In fact, links may form even between sworn enemies. War itself can generate some of the strongest of all human bonds. Historians often argue that globalization reached a first peak in 1913, then went into a long decline during the era of the World Wars and the Cold War, and recuperated only after 1989. This may be true of economic globalization, but it ignores the different but equally important dynamic of military globalization. War spreads ideas, technologies, and people far more quickly than commerce does. In 1918, the United States was more closely linked to Europe than in 1913. The two then drifted apart in the interwar years, only to have their fates inextricably meshed together by the Second World War and the Cold War. War also makes people far more interested in one another. The United States had never been more closely in touch with Russia than during the Cold War, when every cough in a Moscow corridor sent people scrambling up and down Washington staircases. People care far more about their enemies than about their trade partners. For every American film about Taiwan, there are probably 50 about Vietnam. The Medieval Olympics. The world of the early 21st century has gone way beyond forming links between different groups. People across the globe are not only in touch with one another, they increasingly share identical beliefs and practices. 1,000 years ago, planet Earth provided fertile ground to dozens of different political models. In Europe, you could find feudal principalities vying with independent city-states and minuscule theocracies. The Muslim world had its caliphate, claiming universal sovereignty, but it also experimented with kingdoms, sultanates, and emirates. The Chinese empires believed themselves to be the sole legitimate political entity, while to the north and west, tribal confederacies fought each other with glee. India and Southeast Asia contained a kaleidoscope of regimes, whereas polities in America, Africa, and Australasia ranged from tiny hunter-gatherer bands to sprawling empires. No wonder that even neighboring human groups had trouble agreeing on common diplomatic procedures, not to mention international laws. Each society had its own political paradigm and found it difficult to understand and respect alien political concepts. Today, in contrast, a single political paradigm is accepted everywhere. The planet is divided between about 200 sovereign states, which generally agree on the same diplomatic protocols and on common international laws. Sweden, Nigeria, Thailand, and Brazil are all marked on our atlases as the same kind of colorful shapes. They are all members of the United Nations. And, despite myriad differences, they are all recognized as sovereign states enjoying similar rights and privileges. Indeed, they share many more political ideas and practices than not, including at least a token belief in representative bodies, political parties, universal suffrage, and human rights. There are parliaments in Tehran, Moscow, Cape Town, and New Delhi, as well as in London and Paris. When Israelis and Palestinians, Russians and Ukrainians, Kurds and Turks compete for the favors of global public opinion, they all use the same discourse of human rights, state sovereignty, and international law. The world may be peppered with various types of failed states, but it knows only one paradigm for a successful state. Global politics thus follows the Anna Karenina principle. Successful states are all alike, but every failed state fails in its own way, by missing this or that ingredient of the dominant political package. The Islamic State has recently stood out in its complete rejection of this package, and in its attempt to establish an entirely different kind of political entity, a universal caliphate. But precisely for this reason, it has failed. Numerous guerrilla forces and terror organizations have managed to establish new countries or to conquer existing ones. But they have always done so by accepting the fundamental principles of the global political order. Even the Taliban sought international recognition as the legitimate government of the sovereign country of Afghanistan. No group rejecting the principles of global politics has so far gained any lasting control of any significant territory. The strength of the global political paradigm can perhaps best be appreciated by considering not hardcore political questions of war and diplomacy, but rather something like the 2016 Rio Olympics. Take a moment to reflect on the way the games were organized. The 11,000 athletes were grouped into delegations by nationality, rather than by religion, class, or language. There was no Buddhist delegation, proletarian delegation, or English-speaking delegation. Except in a handful of cases, most notably Taiwan and Palestine, determining the athletes' nationality was a straightforward affair. At the opening ceremony on August 5, 2016, the athletes marched in groups, each waving its national flag. Whenever Michael Phelps won another gold medal, the Stars and Stripes was raised to the sound of the Star-Spangled Banner. When Émilie Andéol won the gold medal in judo, the French tricolour was hoisted and La Marseillaise was played. Conveniently enough, each country in the world has an anthem that conforms to the same universal model. Almost all anthems are orchestral pieces of a few minutes in length, rather than a 20-minute chant that can only be performed by a special caste of hereditary priests. Even countries such as Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Congo have adopted Western musical conventions for their anthems. Most of them sound like something composed by Beethoven on a rather mediocre day. You can spend an evening with friends playing the various anthems on YouTube and trying to guess which is which. Even the lyrics are almost the same throughout the world, indicating common conceptions of politics and group loyalty. For example, to which nation do you think the following anthem belongs? I changed only the country's name into the generic My Country. My country, my homeland, the land where I have shed my blood, it is there I stand, to be my motherland's guard. My country, my nation, my people and my homeland, let us proclaim, my country unite. Long live my land, long live my state, my nation, my homeland in its entirety. Build its soul, awaken its body, for my great country. My great country, independent and free, my home and my country which I love, my great country, independent and free, long live my great country. The answer is Indonesia. But would you have been surprised if I told you that the answer was actually Poland, Nigeria, or Brazil? National flags display the same dreary conformity. With a single exception, all flags are rectangular pieces of cloth marked by an extremely limited repertoire of colors, stripes, and geometrical shapes. Nepal is the odd country out, with a flag consisting of two triangles. But Nepal never won an Olympic medal. The Indonesian flag consists of a red stripe above a white stripe. The Polish flag displays a white stripe above a red stripe. The flag of Monaco is identical to that of Indonesia. A colorblind person could hardly tell the difference between the flags of Belgium, Chad, Ivory Coast, France, Guinea, Ireland, Italy, Mali, and Romania. They all have three vertical stripes of various colors. Some of these countries have been engaged in bitter war with one another. But during the tumultuous 20th century, only three Olympic Games were cancelled due to war, in 1916, 1940, and 1944. In 1980, the United States and some of its allies boycotted the Moscow Olympics. In 1984, the Soviet bloc boycotted the Los Angeles Games. And on several other occasions, the Olympics found themselves at the center of a political storm, most notably in 1936, when Nazi Berlin hosted the Games, and in 1972, when Palestinian terrorists massacred the Israeli delegation to the Munich Olympics. Yet, on the whole, political controversies have not derailed the Olympic project. Now let's go back 1,000 years. Suppose you wanted to hold the medieval Olympics in Rio in 1016. Forget for a moment that Rio was then a small village of Tupi Indians, and that Asians, Africans, and Europeans were not even aware of America's existence. Forget the logistical problems of bringing all the world's top athletes to Rio in the absence of airplanes. Forget, too, that few sports were shared throughout the world, and even if all humans could run, not everybody could agree on the same rules for a running competition. Just ask yourself how to group the competing delegations. Today's International Olympic Committee spends countless hours discussing the Taiwan question and the Palestine question. Multiply this by 10,000 to estimate the number of hours you would have to spend on the politics of the medieval Olympics. For starters, in 1016, the Chinese Song Empire recognized no political entity on earth as its equal. It would therefore be an unthinkable humiliation for the Olympic Committee to give its Olympic delegation the same status as that granted to the delegations of the Korean Kingdom of Goryeo or of the Vietnamese Kingdom of Dai Co Viet, not to mention the delegations of primitive barbarians from across the seas. The caliph in Baghdad also claimed universal hegemony, and most Sunni Muslims recognized him as their supreme leader. In practical terms, however, the caliph barely ruled the city of Baghdad. So would all Sunni athletes be part of a single caliphate delegation? Or would they be separated into dozens of delegations from the numerous emirates and sultanates of the Sunni world? But why stop with the emirates and sultanates? The Arabian Desert was teeming with free Bedouin tribes who recognized no overlord save Allah. Would each be entitled to send an independent delegation to compete in archery or camel racing? Europe would give you any number of similar headaches. Would an athlete from the Norman town of Ivry compete under the banner of the local Count of Ivry, of his lord the Duke of Normandy, or perhaps of the feeble King of France? Many of these political entities appeared and disappeared within a matter of years. As you made your preparations for the 1016 Olympics, you would not be able to know in advance which delegations would show up, because nobody could be sure which political entities would still exist next year. If the Kingdom of England had sent a delegation to the 1016 Olympics, by the time the athletes came home with their medals, they would have discovered that the Danes had just captured London, and that England was being absorbed into the North Sea Empire of King Canute the Great, together with Denmark, Norway, and parts of Sweden. Within another 20 years, that empire disintegrated, but 30 years later England was conquered again, this time by the Duke of Normandy. Needless to say, the vast majority of these ephemeral political entities had neither anthem to play nor flag to hoist. Political symbols were of great importance, of course, but the symbolic language of European politics was very different from the symbolic languages of Indonesian, Chinese, and Tupi politics. Agreeing on a common protocol to mark victory would have been all but impossible. So when you watch the Tokyo Games in 2020, remember that this seeming competition between nations actually represents an astonishing global agreement. For all the national pride people feel when their delegation wins a gold medal and their flag is raised, there is far greater reason to feel pride that humankind is capable of organizing such an event. $1 to rule them all. In pre-modern times, humans experimented not only with diverse political systems, but also with a mind-boggling variety of economic models. Russian boyars, Hindu maharajas, Chinese mandarins, and Amerindian tribal chiefs had very different ideas about money, trade, taxation, and employment. Nowadays, in contrast, almost everybody believes in a slightly different variation on the same capitalist theme, and we are all cogs within a single global production line. Whether you live in Congo or Mongolia, in New Zealand or Bolivia, your daily routines and economic fortunes depend on the same economic theories, the same corporations and banks, and the same currents of capital.